Hi, and welcome to Last Man Standing. You're here live with me, Paul Stevenson. This is Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, on Sunday, the 4th of September, 2022. Welcome to the show, everyone. I hope you've had a great weekend. Do support Republic Broadcasting. We rely on that. The easiest way to do that is to go to the homepage, and you can see the various different donate options, everything from PayPal and electronic transactions to postal cash checks and everything else. So if you just go to the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org homepage, you'll see the various different options. With all that said, okay, let's crack on with tonight's show. I'm going to be live here with Patrick Slattery, Dr. Patrick Slattery, of course, of RBN, and UK nationalist Euro, who we had on the show last month as well, and Euro joins us about once a month to talk about various different topics here tonight. We're going to be talking about Russia, Boris Johnson, the G7 price cap on Russian oil exports, and Liz Truss for the Conservative leadership. I was going to say it's a contest, but it's almost a done deal that Liz Truss is going to be the new so-called Conservative and so-called leader. So, with all that said, welcome to the show, lads. Great to have you with me.
Thank you very much.
It's great to be on again, Paul.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you both. And both of you guys are very knowledgeable and informed, so I'm very interested in... I'll tell you what, let's start. We're talking off air. Let's start with... we, of course, had Mikhail Gorbachev, the previous Soviet leader, and who turned out to be the last... Was he the last, pretty much, I think, last Soviet leader, Soviet Union leader? Sorry?
Yes.
He was.
I also want to get into some sort of technicality over the last few days of the Soviet Union after he had resigned as president, maybe technically the speaker of the the People's Assembly, or the Assembly of People's Deputies, might have been technically the head of the Soviet Union, but yeah, he was the last.
Well, I suppose the last leader of the Soviet Union would have actually been whoever was in charge of Tanu Tuva, wouldn't it? Weren't they the last to leave?
Tanu Tuva?
Yeah, there was some sort of, like, once Russia left and all the other states left, there was just like one tiny state left. Maybe it wasn't Tanu Tuva. Maybe it was like it was some other kind of like rump state that was technically still part of the Soviet Union.
Well, yeah, I mean,
okay. Well, what was interesting as well is that he didn't get a state funeral. Putin didn't attend his funeral, and he didn't get a state funeral. So. Let's start with you, Patrick. Give us your thoughts and some context on this character, Mikhail Gorbachev.
Okay. So, I mean, just to get my cards out on the table, I was a big Gorbachev fan in real time. He became the general secretary of the Communist Party in March of 1985. And at that time, general secretary was the ruler of the USSR, and he came in after three of his predecessors had died in about 3.5 years, very feeble people who were old at the end of their lives, and they died one after another. And so the Soviet Union had gone through a lot of and the Soviet system, while the Soviet system of the 70s and the 80s, the Soviet system of the Cold War, wasn't exactly, it wasn't nearly as repressive as it had been in previous decades. Like, obviously, you had a reign of terror after the Russian Revolution, and you had the Holodomor, which was, you know, actually under Stalin's tenure. It was still, you know, it's still very bureaucratic, very heavy-handed, and also very economically very inefficient. And a lot of people just don't understand. But what made a communist country wasn't censorship. It wasn't trannies. It wasn't any of this stuff. What made a communist country was two things. It was state ownership of the means of production and a centrally planned economy. And both of those had been, they had been pioneered in the Soviet Union, and the Soviets still had that system, and it was not efficient. It led to shortages. It led to people, taking time off from work so they could wait in line because, prices were fixed. Prices couldn't go up and down in response to shortages. So people would, leave work and, wait in lines. And of course, if they're not working, then they weren't producing, and that led to more shortages. So you had a system that wasn't going anywhere. Gorbachev came in and wanted to fix the system. You know, he says that he felt like he could have just ridden out another, 20 years as in the style of his predecessors and not fixed anything. Maybe he could have, maybe he couldn't have, but he decided to try to reform things. And honestly, he almost did it. He was really, really close. And, people often talk as if whatever happened in the past was inevitable. I don't think any of this was inevitable. I don't think he had to do reforms, but he decided to do reforms. I think the reforms could have succeeded, but they didn't succeed. And, I think there are reasons for this. And I don't want to dominate the whole discussion, so I'm just going to say one thing that I haven't said before, because if you want to know, more of what I think, I did a show on Thursday on National Bugle Radio that's devoted to this subject. But this is something I did not say. But honestly, if you go back to 1991, the second half of 1991 in particular, when things actually did fall apart, the Russian people had a choice. They had a choice between Mikhail Gorbachev, who had a plan to keep the Soviet Union, to transform it into a union of sovereign republics where you would have more decentralized authority. The central government would have a lot less authority. Or you could go with Boris Yeltsin. You had a choice between Gorbachev and Yeltsin. And the Russian people went with Yeltsin. And this wasn't something imposed on them by Jews in the United States. This was the Russian people. And I was there in September of 1991. And I saw it happen. And they decided they wanted to go with Yeltsin. The Soviet, the Russian people in particular, they screwed up. They went with the wrong person. Yeltsin destroyed the country. It wasn't Gorbachev. It was Yeltsin who destroyed the country. And I've got a lot of sympathy with the Russian people, but they made a choice and they made the wrong choice. And Gorbachev is not a popular figure, and the vast majority of Russian people would very much disagree with me, but that's my position and I'm sticking to it.
Okay. Euro, thoughts on Gorbachev?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different questions there. It comes down to, to what degree was the collapse of the Soviet Union inevitable? Would it have been beneficial for it to collapse regardless? Could we say that since its foundation, it was, an abomination and it was a good thing that it was destroyed? And whether or not that's been good for the Russian people and the situation that we're in now. And, just before we went on air, I said, was the dissolution of the Soviet Union the inevitable result of the glasnost policy or not?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and of course,
anything was inevitable. I think things could have gone a variety of ways. They went the way they did. Things only wind up going one way, but that doesn't mean there weren't other scenarios that were plausible.
Yeah. Is it safe to assume that there is little respect for Gorbachev from Putin as not providing a state funeral and not attending the funeral? He did. There was some footage of him
on RT, attending, you know, like a wake, where the body is, in an open coffin, where he, attended that and prayed. But no state funeral and no Vladimir Putin at the funeral. Euro.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you can view that two ways. You may look at that and say, Putin acted in that way and didn't organize a state funeral because he didn't like what Gorbachev was trying to do. Or you could say that he valued what Gorbachev was trying to do, but thought that he was an idiot or incompetent for failing. Or possibly he just thought that the Russian people would have not viewed Gorbachev as anything other than a failure. And so, you know, as kind of bowing to public pressure, he didn't want to do something which would make himself unpopular.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Also, you mentioned the Russian people screwed up, Patrick. What did Yeltsin at least propose to offer that caused the Russian people to choose this absolute clown that basically was a public humiliation, really, for the Russian people?
So Yeltsin's position over the during the late 1980s, because Yeltsin had been in the Politburo, and he was the same age as Gorbachev, and they were both considered young. They were young up-and-comers. Gorbachev had gotten into the Politburo before Yeltsin had, but they were the same age, and they were rivals. And Yeltsin, he left the Politburo, and he started becoming basically an independent politician. He was a critic, and he was a critic of Gorbachev for not doing the reforms fast enough. His whole thing was that the reforms need to be faster. So, I mean, the thing is, to the extent you're going to say that, you know, the reforms led to the breakup of the Soviet Union and led to this disaster. And by the way, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people think, well, the Soviet Union was an abomination, and so it's a good thing that it broke up. But a lot of people look at the consequence of the breaking up of one of two superpowers as, well, it created a world with one superpower, and that hasn't worked out so well. To have the sole Zionist-dominated American superpower, that hasn't worked out so well. So a lot of people look at the breakup of the Soviet Union as being a geopolitical tragedy. But the thing is, Yeltsin's position had always been Gorbachev is too timid on reforms. And so if the reforms made the breakup inevitable, and I don't think they did, but if that's what you think, well, I mean, Yeltsin's position was always you have to do more. It has to be faster. It has to be more radical. And the Russian people in the autumn, you know, late summer and autumn of 1991, They were with Yeltsin. And I had been to the Soviet Union three times. I went before Gorbachev. I went while Gorbachev was popular. And then I went that last trip I made was right after the putsch, where Gorbachev had been, where his vice president and defense minister had attempted a coup against him, and they had surrounded his vacation home, cut it off from communications with the outside world and tried to get him to resign. And he refused, and they never, and his own presidential guard kept the coup keepers forces outside of the compound. But nevertheless, the compound was cut off from outside communication. And, you know, the whole thing wound up being a farce and an embarrassment. And it really catapulted the popularity of Yeltsin, because Gorbachev was incommunicado. Yanayev, the vice president, he went on to announce Gorbachev's resignation, and he appeared drunk and unsure of himself. And then Yeltsin gets up on a tank that, you know, the defense minister ordered into the square in front of the Yeltsin at the time was the head of the Russian government, and the Russian government was basically still, Russia was still a republic within the Soviet Union. And Yeltsin responded by just walking up on top of, climbs up on top of the tank and gives a speech. And then the coup makers retreated. And so it made Yeltsin look really cool. And the Russian people went with him. And then when Gorbachev came, when Gorbachev reemerged, Yeltsin publicly humiliated him, and the Russian people were laughing. I remember just being on an Aeroflot flight, a domestic flight within the Soviet Union, and I didn't speak Russian very well. I was studying it, but I didn't really speak it. But this peasant woman, who literally had brought chickens with her. I mean, she had chickens. They weren't in the cabin, but they were down below. I saw her with the chickens, and she got up and she was saying, talking about Gorbachev, and everybody on the plane was laughing, and she was just making fun of Gorbachev. And it was like just a massive humiliation. But that was the mood at the time. And the Russian people just threw caution with the wind, and they went with Yeltsin, and that was a huge mistake. That's my position, and I'm sticking to it. I am unanimous in that.
Okay. All right. Let's get up to speed with what's happening more recently. I thought it was a very interesting story. This was a story broken by Foreign Affairs, which is a pro-Western, pro-Ukrainian news outlet, that there was an early April peace agreement pretty much almost in place. And then there was a surprise visit from Boris Johnson and things changed. And this was a peace agreement that was set to be agreed at the end of April, so very early on in this process. And it says, according to multiple former senior U.S. officials we spoke with, in April of 2022, Russian and Ukrainian negotiators appear to have tentatively agreed on the outline of a negotiated interim settlement. Russia would withdraw its position when it controlled part of the Donbass region and all of Crimea, and in exchange, Ukraine would promise not to seek NATO membership and instead receive security guarantees from a number of countries. And so Johnson then turns up, and there was another story in another pro-Western outlet, and it said it gave more details on the whole situation. I'm just trying to find it here, but it quotes what Johnson was telling Zelensky and those in Kiev. But it's interesting. So it says, the outlet Ukrainska Pravda, again pro-Western, pro-Ukrainian, pledging support wasn't the only reason for Johnson's visit. Sources close to Zelensky told the paper that Johnson was an obstacle to the peace talks because he brought two simple messages. The first is that Putin is a war criminal; he should not be he should be pressured, not negotiated with. And the second is that even if Ukraine is ready to sign some agreement on guarantees with Putin, they are not, presumably, you know, who he represents, the UK and the West. Johnson's position was that the collective West now felt that Putin was not really as powerful as they had previously imagined, and that here was a chance to, quote, press him. So here we have Johnson basically keeping this whole, scam going and keeping the whole meat grinder going. On there. So thoughts on that, lads? Who wants to jump in first? Feel free.
That's a very interesting term they've used, the collective West. It's just a euphemism for international Jewry, essentially.
Exactly.
You know, we know that Boris himself is at least part Jewish. Zelensky is Jewish. The war between Ukraine and Russia can't be really understood without understanding the history of the Jewish involvement in the Soviet Union. You know, the terrible crimes which were committed against Ukraine by the Soviets with use of Russian soldiers that caused this hatred in the first place, which now the Jewish leader of Ukraine uses to get them to fight their own kin in Russia. You know, it's a complicated situation, but that aspect can't be ignored. I think as time's gone on, Russia's position has really only got stronger. Obviously, we see that the West is just going to dump as many weapons in there as they can to try and drag this thing out and to bleed Russia. But Russia's ties with China have really deepened a lot recently. You know, they've put in other arrangements with regards to
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, India. With regards to energy and resources and other things, and they're really strengthening their position over time. Whereas the longer things drag on and the closer we get to a cold winter in Europe, you know, we're going to have masses of businesses shutting down because they can't afford to keep the lights on, not to mention the you know, just ordinary people who can't afford to heat their houses, and the massive effects that's going to have on politics as people search for any alternative, no matter what that might be.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you've had this G7 farce where they're putting a price cap on Russian exports. Russia have already, almost immediately after this announcement, denounced any intention to sell oil to any of the G7 countries, and they will only sell it at market price. Hardly surprising.
The market price, which is inflated by the very actions of the Europeans in the first place.
Yeah, and also, I mean, what's happening is, you know, this idea that Russia needs to. I heard this clown, some talking head on GB News, and he's talking about this because Putin has turned off the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. I would have done it a long time ago. And they seem to be outraged by this. I mean, considering the aggression with these sanctions towards Putin, somehow Putin is unreasonable. He's kept this thing on for a lot longer than I would have. But so there's a guy on GB News, he goes, Putin is trying it on here because he has to fund the war in Ukraine, and the only way he funds it is by selling gas to the West. I mean, how deluded are these guys? I mean, do they really believe this? I mean, Russia is selling more gas and oil and natural gas now to China, India, places like that than they've ever done to the West. This year alone, they've sold 2.5 million tons of liquid natural gas to China. And then what's happening is China, at a you know, significantly higher markup price, is selling it to Europe. I mean, you couldn't make it up. So we're actually buying Russian oil anyway. It's just going via China, and then we're paying more for it. But this idea that, that Putin needs, you know, he's trying it on. You know, it's like a bluff here, you know, that he's only able to fund his war machine by selling it to Europe. I mean, these guys, I don't know what kind of reality they live in. It's just, I think they're in denial as much as they're ignorant. Patrick.
So, back in March, you had Ukrainian and Russian delegations go to Ankara, to Turkey. That's where these talks were taking place. And I'm not aware of the details that they were moving towards, but they were making, you know, they were at least talking. And this is something that Alexander Mercolis was reporting on in real time and has referred back to frequently. You did have, this did happen, and it's been known for a long time that Boris Johnson, you know, he went to visit Zelensky and said, look, no, you know, go for the victory, go for the victory. Of course, there's not going to be a Ukrainian military victory. There never was any chance of a Ukrainian military victory. And this whole project, the point of the project has been to use the war on the ground as a way of cementing anti-Russian, anti-Putin sentiment around the world so that you could have a regime of sanctions that would lead to the overthrowing of Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. And to the extent that that was ever any kind of viable plan, it's been obvious since the early days of the war that it wasn't going to happen. It's not going to happen without China being on board. And of course, it's not just China. You got India. You got all these Indonesia. You got a lot of big
Africa
nations. You got all sorts of big countries that can be alternative economic partners for Russia. But China's the big one. China is the big enchilada there. And so it's clear that it was never going to happen. And as this war goes on, the negotiating the possible negotiating positions keep moving. The Russian objectives are moving. The Russian objective for 8 years had simply been the Minsk Accord. The Minsk Accord, which was for the reincorporation of the Donbass into Ukraine with guarantees of rights for ethnic Russians. Those are very minimal demands. And then just before the war began, you had the demilitarization of, you had non-membership in NATO became a condition. And then after the war began, or as the war was beginning, the demilitarization of Ukraine. Well, as the longer things go on, the more and more these demands are shifting. And it's clear now that the Russian position now includes that Ukraine, whatever is left of Ukraine, no longer rules over significant numbers of ethnic Russians. That they don't think that the Ukrainian government can be trusted to rule over ethnic Russians. And so that means you're going to have an incorporation of not just Lugansk and Donetsk, not just Crimea, but it's going to be Zaporozhye, it's going to be Kherson, it's going to be Odessa, it's going to be Kharkov, it's going to be Mykolaiv. All these provinces that have, 40-50% Russian populations, they are going to be incorporated into the new Russia. And, the longer this goes
like Pac-Man.
Yeah, it's gobble, 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 gobble. And
well, the longer this thing goes on, as you say, the war aims of Russia are just expanding, because there's no reason not to. With every action that the West, the so-called collective West, take against Russia, they're just showing more and more that there's no reason to act conservatively and to be cautious, because they will stop at nothing to inflict any blow that they can upon Russia. And while they're failing at it, I think the longer this goes on, we're going to see Russia possibly want a full annexation of Ukraine, or maybe leaving just a very small rump state. But I'm sure there are people within the Russian government and Russian military who are working towards that. As we know, Kiev was the historical capital of Russia, of the founding of Russia, the Kievan Rus. But, the longer it goes on as well, they're deepening these ties with China. As you say, they're making Russia's still getting the same money. In fact, they're getting more money because the market price for oil is going up. So they can sell that on for more. Then China buys it and sells it to the West. So Russia make more money than they would have in the first place. And China are benefiting economically from it. Yeah, I really wonder, to what degree, because we've had since all this COVID lockdown, they started talking about, now we need a climate lockdown and we need the great reset. One's allowed to drive a car anymore. How much of this is a coincidence and how much is not, that we are literally not going to be able to turn the lights on or drive everywhere? And even if that's exactly what the people in power want, have they really thought this through?
Well, you've only got two options when it comes to this G7 insanity. That these people are absolutely and utterly retarded, because they must know. They can't be that stupid. If we know that Russia is getting stronger, it's selling more oil to places like India and China than it ever sold to the West, It immediately came out almost and just laughed and said, okay, well, we'll not send any oil at that price to any of the G7 countries. I mean, as if they're desperate, like this talking head in GB News seems to think. So the other option is that they are deliberately doing it, because while Putin rubs his hands and gets, with glee, we'll be rubbing our hands to keep warm here, in Europe. Now, we won't get it as bad, but the net zero policies that we have adopted, and we'll get to Liz Truss and her absurd, doubled sort of speak on this. She still thinks that she's going to strive for net zero, all the while do fracking and actually do fossil fuels. So she's obviously lying. I think the safest thing to conclude is that they are deliberately darkening and freezing Europe.
darkening like in more ways than one.
No, for sure. Because this is going to be a complete and utter disaster, what's happening here with energy in Europe. I mean, Germany have turned on the coal plants. We're not even turning on the coal plants. We don't rely on Russia so much. But, you know, Germany and other Europeans really do. So, yeah, this seems to me to be an acceleration of the attack on the West and essentially to turn it into a third world backward, you know, a continent, and well, they're doing it demographically as well, and bring in this great reset thing, create the crisis, and then I suppose create some solution for it. Patrick, looking across the pond, how do you see things developing for Europe?
Well, I mean, there's going to be, we are going to have a winter of crises, I'm using the plural of it. You know, you're going to have bunch of European governments that are going to fall. I mean, yeah, you've got the Olaf Scholz and Annalena Ballerina, his foreign minister, the green lady.
Annalena Baerbock, out. Yeah,
I call her Annalena Ballerina, and she has said she doesn't even care what the German people think that. And, you know, that's not sustainable. That's not sustainable, especially because the Ukrainians are just losing bigger and bigger and bigger. And that, you know, it you can't hide that from people forever. So,
yeah,
you're going to have all these crises. You're going to have crises in America because, you know, the Biden is increasingly, it's hard to hide his level of senility. The Vice President Chlamydia is not at all popular. If she becomes president, you're going to have a crisis because she won't be able to appoint a vice president because the Congress won't cooperate with her. And you're going to have a constitutional crisis here, probably based on having a vacant vice presidency while the president is perhaps facing impeachment for something. You're just going to end your economic crises, and the whole West is going to be in turmoil. And, yeah, you know, was it planned? I think, you know, honestly, I think to a large extent, this is people being retarded. The people who are in charge, they're not that smart. They're really not. I don't think they're as smart as our listeners are, for instance, but they're in charge for a variety of reasons, but it's not necessarily because of high IQ.
Now, you say they're in charge for a variety of reasons. I think they're mainly just in charge for one reason. But that's neither here nor there. Now, we have seen that Biden, in a speech which was obviously written for him because he's too senile to do anything himself without behind-the-scenes string pullers.
All right, what is that one reason? What's the one reason that you were talking about? Because our listeners are going to wonder what is the one reason.
Well, I don't know. What is it that links all these people, all these globalists around the world? You know, what is the one thing that they've all got in common? Who knows?
Serving the Jews.
Yes, they're members of the Chinese Communist Party, according to Alex Jones.
You were talking about Biden. Sorry.
Yeah, Biden was saying in this speech, which was obviously written for him by his handlers, about just this absolute crackdown, essentially, you know, wanting to criminalize and call millions of voters who voted for Trump to be terrorists, just criminalizing being a white person in America.
Fascists.
You know, anyone who voted for Trump is a fascist. And then, as Patrick was saying about, you've got in Germany, you've got politicians who openly say, you know, their role is not to help the people in the country who elected them, but to do something for people of another country. And then I think in Sweden is going to join NATO now, and they've said that the Swedish people don't get a vote in whether they want to join NATO because it's just too important. It's just too, you know, in order to save democracy, it's just so important that there's no democracy in that choice, you know, because if we allow people to vote on whether or not we should save democracy, they'll vote no. So in order to save democracy, we can't have any.
Well, Well, these people are impervious to irony because, of course, that's why, you see, it's our great liberal democracies against these authoritarian regimes like Putin. And this is why we must sacrifice and be freezing over the winter to protect our democracies. But as both of you alluded to, German foreign minister, the operative word here is German, Annalena Baerbock said that she has made a commitment to Ukraine, and she will see that through, quote, no matter what my German voters think. So that's how we protect our democracies, literally, just to the point you made there, Euro. So it's insanity. As I say, these people are impervious to irony and their own absurd double standards. Staying on the same topic, I thought it was quite interesting that the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, the Ukrainians have obviously been shelling it. I thought it was a great move on Russia's part to invite in the United Nations inspectors. But yet, mainstream media, even though they're obviously in a pickle with this, because on one hand they acknowledge that this is a nuclear plant occupied by Russian forces, and of course they say they can't really outright blame Russia for it. So what they're saying is both sides are blaming the other side for the shelling. So by that, we're supposed to maybe believe that Russia is shelling a plant that it actually occupies.
Yeah, I mean, what is it they always do when they have one of these wars, and it's like, they did this in the Balkans as well. They'll get people that the Americans are supporting to fire weapons, like from just outside a hospital or something, and then the enemy will fire back, just pinpointing wherever that was fired from. They'll locate that target and they'll just fire back at the exact coordinates, and then you get the propaganda. Oh my God, these evil Russians or Serbians or whatever are shelling hospitals. They want to kill babies. They're just the metaphorical manifestation of evil.
The atrocity propaganda.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same thing. I wonder if, you know, they're not even claiming that the Russians are shelling them from the power plant anymore.
Well, before the UN came in there, that's exactly what they were doing, because the atrocity propaganda had already rolled out that Russia was these absolute maniacs were going to destroy this nuclear plant and basically kill everybody in Ukraine and Russia and God knows wherever else. So was an astute move, I reckon, on Russia's part, Patrick, inviting them in there, because it's very hard to say that when you've got a plant which is controlled by Russian forces and then invited in the United Nations that Russia are responsible for, you know, shelling their own plant at this stage, essentially.
Well, yeah, the Russians had invited them in. The Ukrainians tried to prevent it. And even as the International Atomic Energy Agency, even as their personnel were on their way to the plant, you had Ukrainian commandos launching some sort of mission against, you know, to recapture the plant. It's just bizarre stuff, sending dozens or maybe a few hundred commandos on some sort of mission, a suicide mission. And, you know, the thing is, Zelensky just keeps sending wave after wave of effective kamikazes, with no chance of success on all these suicide missions to defend some area or to recapture some area. And I say it's just a matter of time before his own generals manage to overthrow him. I'm sure it would have happened already if overthrowing somebody was easy.
He doesn't care about the lives of those people that he throws into the meat grinder. This is Soviet human wave tactics, and he doesn't care because they're not his people. He is not a Slav. He is not one of them. He just directs them against their own ethnic kin.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a tragedy. But I thought it was a great move from Putin because, as I say, it's very difficult to then argue. But of course they've tried, because they interviewed, it was in Channel 4 News, they interviewed the mayor of Zaporizhia, and he's now saying, oh, you can't believe anything that comes out of the UN now, because, you know, this is all controlled and filtered from Russian propaganda. So now you see, in a situation, despite
By the way, I saw this guy from the leader of this United Nations inspector group, quite a charismatic and very articulate guy, stated that there's been huge cooperation from the Russians. There is tension because you have some Ukrainian nuclear experts in there with Russian nuclear experts, but they're cooperating. They realize that there's no point not cooperating, and the Russians have been pretty hospitable to them, and that they don't feel under any threat, and that the Russians have assured them that they can report absolute truth and that they won't be interfered with. And this guy was quite convincing. So now they're having to basically start questioning the UN, which spanks of absolute desperation. I think that's going to backfire too.
Yeah, I think we're in the end games, and because obviously the war can't go on forever. No country can lose and lose and lose like the Ukrainians are losing forever. It can't happen. They're running out of troops, they're running out of munitions, and there's going to be some sort of collapse. And, you know, for some people, for the American administration, maybe the name of the game is just to keep this going past the midterm elections. And, you know, maybe in some European capitals, there's some similar kind of calculus. But sooner or later, the Ukrainian army is just going to collapse. Russia is going to emerge completely victorious.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. There's only so much they can keep this nonsense going that there's actually a genuine fight going on there. I mean, it's a very one-sided situation. And, you know, if Russia really wanted to bring out the big guns, they could, because, you know, Russia have been trying to, from my understanding, if I listen to people like Douglas McGregor, they've been trying to do this with as little collateral damage and as little human, fatalities as possible. So, you know, that's why, another reason why it's taken longer, because, you know, Russia, guess what, doesn't indulge in, carpet bombing tactics like the United States do in the Middle East, when they flatten everywhere and reduce it to rubble and don't care what they're bombing. All right, I've covered what I wanted to cover. I guess, we could talk a little bit about Liz Truss. She's the most likely leader.
Yeah, I think that's worth talking about. I mean, yeah. I'm sure I mentioned on the previous show when we talked about this, it's going to come down to incompetent or brown, and I don't think there's really going to be a lot of difference there, because Liz Truss being so incompetent is just going to be completely controlled. She's not going to have much of an agenda of her own. She'll just do whatever she's told. I think that Rishi Sunak would be much the same, but, you know, he's actually, you know, is they're both going to be just as anti-white, but at least as a visibly brown person, there might be some more pushback against him doing it. So I think if anything, you know, it's kind of preferable for people to see directly what's going on than for them to have the illusion it's not and still happen anyway.
Yeah. Well, Patrick, you and I had a show about Liz Truss where I think when you look at the two options, are they willing participants? They know what's going on. They say one thing but do another. But, you know, they're part more or less of the Jewish establishment, knowingly and willingly destroying the West. Or you have people like Liz Truss who are basically not too bright. I think we concluded that she's in the latter category, not too bright, and sort of gets taken into a room and probably gets propagandized herself, and then operates on that basis, thinking she's doing the right thing, you know.
You know who she reminds me of? You remember the Thin Blue Line with Rowan Atkinson?
Yeah.
She's like the policeman wife. Do you remember?
Yeah,
she had a policeman wife,
and
she was complaining to him. She was once in his office, and she was complaining about their marriage, and she said, you know, you never do this, you never do that. And, you know, It would be nice every now and then to have a damn good Rogering. And just as she said that, the black police officer walked in, and Rowan Atkinson looks up and says, we were just talking about that fellow Ring, you know, Roger Ring, and how damn good he is. But that's who Liz Truss reminds me of. I don't know about you guys. And I don't know if she needs a damn good Roger.
I can see that, yeah. I can see what you mean. And also, her views on immigration. I mean, she's dancing around that issue as well.
They all will be. You're not going to get much of a difference, as I say, regardless of who's in power. But, you know, if it comes down to the same policies either way, somebody who's visibly not British, not European, not white at all, is kind of preferable because it's going to create more hostility towards more pushback against these anti-white actions, which are going to happen regardless. So in that sense, I say bring on Rishi, you know.
Yeah, and also, I mean, actually, it's a bit of a cheek, really, considering his policies, his fiscal policies. But he's now actually talking economic sense and saying, you know, you're living in dreamland, Liz, if you think you're going to like lower taxes and reduce VAT, et cetera, and basically we need to tighten our belt. So he's suddenly taking a conservative position, whereas, you know, he was apparently a conservative chancellor before COVID, and then he basically woke up, you know, after the COVID thing as Jeremy Corbyn, and plunged the country into, you know, what the inflation crisis that we're seeing now. But Liz Truss thinks she's talking to appease the conservative voters. And to an extent, you know, she's essentially selling more socialism in a roundabout way, because she's talking about lowering taxes, lowering VAT and things like this. But the country's broke. So if it's going to deal with the deficits in the national debt, the reality is the taxes need to be risen. Because
we're going to fix the economy. We're going to fix the economy whilst embargoing Russia, guys. I have a brilliant plan. It's all going to work.
And so she's going to try and, you know, appeal to the conservative base by lowering taxes and lowering VAT when the actual government are broke and in debt to their teeth, and so they'll print up more money to cover it. And so, yeah. I mean, I think that she's quite capable, and I think it's quite likely you're going to see a serious, serious collapse in the system.
I mean, honestly,
and it's already happening.
If I want a cunning plan, I'm going to go to one of Rowan Atkinson's other co-stars, Baldrick, because that's who's got a cunning plan. I don't think it's this Liz Truss lady. Are you getting my
Baldrick
reference?
Baldrick was actually very intelligent. He was on Time Team, after all. He was an archaeologist. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Yeah, it's going to be shit either way, no matter who's in charge. And I've completely forgotten what I was going to say there, so that's kind of pointless, sorry.
We were talking about Baldrick.
It was before that derailment, actually.
He's got a cunning plan.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think that the sterling has already taken a significant drop, and, you know, what is it now? We get one €1.15 for a pound. It wasn't that long ago. That was like more like €1.30, I think. And essentially, the euro has dropped to, it's basically, you know, it's all even now with the dollar. $1 is €1, and that used to, I think, it wasn't that long ago, €1 would have gotten you, I don't know, maybe like $1.15 or something. So,
The exchange rates are all messed up. I mean, I remember when we used to get $2 for a pound And that hasn't happened for a very long time now. But I remember what I was going to say. Despite all this economic hardship that we're having, there's always more money in the bank. That it can be printed out of thin air, not for the NHS, not for things that we actually need, but to put up economic migrants in four-star hotels. There are hotels up and down this country that are being paid by the government at extortionate rates to house foreign, non-European economic migrants who just turn up on boats, get everything paid for, and, you know, where is all this money coming from? Even the taxi service that our Coast Guard and Navy go and pick them up have spent £500 million on fuel since the beginning of the year. You know, there's always money for these things, but we're told that we don't have enough for, for everything else.
Yeah, 5 million a day it costs the British taxpayer to house immigrants that we've been trying for years to stop coming into the country. It's an absolute disgrace and a scandal. Boris Johnson in the UK has sent 2.5 billion to Ukraine in this current economic climate. I mean, to say this is taking the piss, it's gone too far, so excuse me, I don't know, that's probably, shouldn't use that language, I don't know whether that's considered rude in the United States. But, I mean, something's got to give. I mean, this is just an absolute, hammering. It's just the middle finger permanently, displayed and shoved down the throats of the British people, you know?
People will talk about the petrodollar or the dollar as the, world reserve currency, its unique position as the world reserve currency. But we've got foreign exchange markets where so-called hard currencies are traded, and they're converted one into another, and you know, they sometimes one goes up, sometimes another goes up. But the hard currencies, you got the dollar, the euro, the yen as the big three, and then Australian dollar, Swiss franc, Canadian dollar. You got some others that are kind of, and the pound sterling. They're there as well. Of course, those all represent Western currencies. So it's not so much that the petrodollar is the main thing. It's not so much the dollar as the reserve currency, but these hard currencies, you know, when one goes up, others go down. But they kind of, as a group, all these countries have the ability to print money out of thin air, and they take advantage of this in a way that Argentina or Zimbabwe can't. So they do this. But this is really what's potentially coming to an end. And right now, out of all of those hard currencies, all of them have gone down with the exception of the dollar. So the dollar has benefited. The dollar yen, I think, is at a 30-year high right now. You know, it's over 140. And just 6 months ago, it was 110. So you've got, and the thing is, the dollar, it's completely unsustainable. There's no reason that the dollar should be strengthening this much. And there are other.
Well, why is it? Why is it? Because of false confidence? People are seeing it as a safe haven wrongly, and the penny hasn't dropped yet?
Yeah, it's the safe haven. There are several different issues that enter into foreign exchange rates. And, you know, sometimes it's interest rate differentials. Sometimes it's trade balances. They'll look at these different things, political factors. This one is you know, if you have a world crisis, the dollar is a safe haven. And, you know, under what circumstances does one mechanism work as opposed to another? It's all at the whims of the foreign exchange dealers. But there's no.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, I know. There's no good reason for this. And inflation in the United States is already bad enough. But if the dollar went from its current vaulted heights where it's, you know, it's more valuable than a euro and it's 140 yen, if all of a sudden the dollar crashes, the United States is completely dependent on other countries for imports. I mean, inflation's just going to go through the roof.
Particularly, particularly China, who they're so hostile to. So they're going to be some very tough times for America coming down the tracks.
Yeah.
We're going to see massive inflation, possibly even hyperinflation in multiple European countries. And God knows what that's going to get to in America.
Yeah, you already noticed it. Like, I mean, £100 just doesn't feel like £100 anymore. It just feels like this is kind of, I don't know. Do you notice this euro? There's just this sensation that it's like £100 just feels like, I don't know, feels like it's, I don't know, 40.
Yeah, I know that Nativist, my former co-host on TASOB show that we used to do, made a point of saying that during the COVID so-called crisis, the money supply was increased by a ridiculous amount. It was like 50% or nearly doubled or something. So they've just printed this huge amount of money and devalued the currency to about half of what it was in the space of 2 years. You know, so that money is effectively worth less, if not entirely worthless. But it's just going to get more and more worthless as time goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, and then with the rising energy costs, this is just a perfect storm of crisis, unrest, misery. I don't know why. I mean, I'm a little bit worried about it. I suppose my faith keeps me from worrying about it too much. I suppose I trust the Lord that my circumstances will be as such that I won't suffer too much. Because I didn't during COVID. I actually enjoyed COVID. I didn't take a vaccine. I didn't wear a mask. I had more money than I ever had. There was no traffic in the roads. I kept going to gardening work. I mean, our clients are very, very wealthy people. Most of them are above this kind of, inflation stuff. They couldn't care less. You know, their houses are worth 10, 12, 20 million. So I suppose I don't worry about it, but you know, it's a weekly basis now. I mean, you go to Tesco, it's like, oh, mayonnaise was, that was 145 not so long ago. Now it's 245, and then you know, everything just seems to be going up on a weekly basis, and it is a little disconcerting. You're thinking, okay, when's this going to stop? Because I'm not going to be able to buy these things very soon. You know, final thoughts, absolutely, lads. I know we're painting a grim picture, but final thoughts on all of it, and any advice you have for our listeners for.
I'll just say, you know, we're going to be facing harsh times. We don't know quite how harsh things are going to be, but we know it's bad and it's going to get worse. So stock up on dry goods and things that you know you're going to need. And just be sure that if the country really can't heat anywhere, just remember that we're better evolved to deal with harsh winters. That's how we survived in Europe in the first place. And maybe all the rest will just die off in turn. You know, bit of frostbite.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. Patrick?
Well, we're headed into a lot of crises. We'll have an economic crisis, at least high inflation. We're going to have shortages. We're going to have all sorts of things. And crisis, political crises. Where there are crises, there are opportunities. It's not like I'm saying never let a perfectly good crisis go to waste. That's not what I'm saying. But when you got these crises, and you know, for instance, in the case of the Ukrainian war, you've got such an obvious Jewish connection to it, with Zelensky being Jewish, with the big three people at the State Department being Jewish. You know, with the Biden administration having being so top heavy with Jews, the media, this is a perfect time to point out some things that are obvious to us and are going to be increasingly difficult to hide. So where there are crises, there are opportunities. Let's take advantage of the opportunities.
I was just going to say, go ahead. The Zionist world financial system is collapsing, so start building your national socialist barter economy today.
Well, I was going to say that just to Patrick's point, and I agree that their system is collapsing, and Putin is exacerbating that, and I think he's playing chess while they're playing checkers, and I don't know whether they don't realize it or whether it's deliberate or what, but to me it's insanity. But I think when people are hungry and they're desperate, they're much more inclined to not want to be so polite about offending people and being accused of being anti-Semitic.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. Thank you guys for joining me. And we, the three of us, are going to actually be joining Andrew Carrington Hitchcock on his show tomorrow on the Dankoff Report with Mark Dankoff, which is always a great show. I thought the last show we did was great. We covered a lot of points, and Mark's fantastic, I think, as Mark Dankoff on the Rents Network tomorrow. That's Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, ACH.com. That is at 10 a.m. Sorry, it'll be 8 a.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern, and 2 p.m. over here where we are, Euro. So that'll be myself, Euro, and Patrick, with Andrew Carrington Hitchcock and Mark Dankoff tomorrow. I will also be on with David Duke tomorrow with DavidDuke.com, as I am every Monday. I think that's a pre-recorded show. Sometimes we record it on a Monday and it goes out on Tuesday. Other times we just do it live on Monday, but it'll be either tomorrow live at, 4 p.m. My time. So it's 10 a.m. Central. And then I'm on with Richard Carey, on here in RBN again, at midday Central Time and beyond the official narrative. Patrick, you never know. Maybe, we'll do a show on your show, later in the week at some point. But, thank you for joining us, lads. All right.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Well, it was a pleasure. Yes, indeed. And again, thank you for joining me. Okay, folks, I will be back here as well on Last Man Standing, which will be the 11th, I think, Sunday the 11th of September. So thank you for joining me. Take care and God bless.